My hometown, Bruce Springsteen, from the album Born in the USA, released on this day in 1984. It's kind of prescient in some ways, because when you talk about black and white, we're talking about black, white, Latino, Latino, and black in our communities, born in our hometown, part of our hometown. What do we do about the tensions going on? We are joined here in the studio once again by Dr. Lawrence Brown, who's a political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University in the School of Health and Policy. Luis Larin joins us once again, leadership organizer for the United Workers. Lawrence Grand Prix is with us, assistant director for research and public policy for the Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and an alumni of the Baltimore City Public School System. And we're also, Brenda Zavala should be joining us very soon, who was a solitarian at Digital Harbor and a Casa de Maryland youth leader. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner with your thoughts. 410-319-8888. So we saw this tragedy of young Hector Torres, who was stabbed to death. He was, one story I said 15, one said 17. I'm not sure he had his exact age. He was a dropout from the Baltimore City Public School System. And they were alleging the man who killed him was also the man who was in a getaway, killed a young girl, 12 years old, when his car that he stole hit the van she was in. But having said all that, what came out of this also was that Latino students at Digital Harbor High School saying that they felt threatened by certain groups of African American young people in that school, and it increased the tensions. And so I'm just curious your initial reaction. Our initial reaction was, of course, the police should be there to make sure that things don't get out of hand and nobody's hurt, and that's their job, is to be outside of school to do that. And we would be complaining if they weren't there to quell violence and not let violence happen to young people. But I'm curious what we think might have been other ways to address this, what we could have done in this immediate situation to really explore and move in when it comes to these. It is a real divide. I mean, we really want to admit it or not, it's a real divide between black and Latino kids and black and Latino communities. This morning, we just said digression, because I'm going to bring that up to you in a moment. I got a letter, it's on my desk, I'll get in here, from a man who said, I just took a picture of a work site, sent it to me. There's not one black face in this work site. Why don't our men have jobs? So we'll come to that second. But so the feelings are deep. Lawrence, you're about to say what? I can see you had it. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here.
I think there is a divide, but I think the divide is perhaps more from people not knowing than from deep racial animus. And I think that we need to be very careful not to spectacularize instances of black, Latino divisions in a way that the media may be able to, like, sell papers or have an image of a quote-unquote race war that stirs emotions but may not reflect reality. Like I said, I was part of the Baltimore City school system, and I didn't see any non-black people in my classes until I got to Baltimore City College. I eventually went to school on the West Coast and got exposed to people of multiple different races, but many people from Baltimore still live in pretty homogenous communities. And so it comes a lot from just simply not knowing your neighbor of any race, and you have a population of quote-unquote Latinos that some people think that's a homogenizing term. There's a lot of diversity in that community that has nearly doubled in Baltimore over the past decade. And so people just are very unsettled not knowing what's going on. And I think that instead of focusing on policing as the solution, things like engagement that's happening in many ways unseen in our communities and cultural competency on both sides would be a better solution long-term to this problem.
Luis, I mean, you've been, how long have you lived in Baltimore? 20 years, 21 years?
No.
15?
Less.
Something.
No, less.
Eight, whatever that number is.
Eight, okay.
So I'm always, listen, I don't put numbers in front of me. I never get so things good. Right. But so it's been 8 years. Feels like I've known you longer, but okay, it's 8 years. So you do in many ways represent the immigrant community, people who come here from Honduras, El Salvador, mm-hmm. Guatemala, different places like as you came from, and less people from Mexico as well. So when you read this, what was your initial reaction?
Well, thanks for having me.
Always good to have you.
My first reaction was trying to go deep into like what caused these tensions. You know, like in terms of like not into the racial tension. You know, not into the oh, people just hate each other tension, but like what is under, like what people are living in, you know? And like, I really appreciate what this thing of like not trying to avoid what the media always do of like putting these things like wars that they are, you know, and trying to bring it back to the humanity and trying to bring it back to what people is going through, like human beings. What caused the tension, what caused the pressure in your life to react in one way or other. And I think for me, the first reaction was, it was shocking and of course was sad and you know, like just thinking about, in a way, angry about like why or younger people are choosing these tactics or these methods, you know, like why this happened, and not necessarily mad at this particular person or the other, but like seeing our society falling apart, you know, and seeing our society having this way to resolve issues is just violently. And this is not just our community. This is our society in general. Like, how many wars are we in? You know, like, how much violence is around? And so to me, that was like, this is also a reminder of like why Dr. King worked so hard on the nonviolence and the unite across color lines, you know, like that like how critical that was in those times and how critical is that in these times too. For me, that was the first thought was like the speech of Dr. King saying that, you know, there's millions of people in this country and that have very little or nothing to lose. And if they get unite, that will be make a huge difference, and that was my first. That was the first thing that came to my mind. You know, like why Dr. King was so interested in that, and how we need to re-engage on that unity, that deep unity of as human beings.
Lawrence, I'm glad you're here.
Well, I think racism is a funny thing. You know, as we become a more and more multicultural society, we're starting to see different instances of violence that don't fit the common narrative. For instance, George Zimmerman was Jewish and Hispanic. Donald Tokovic Sterling, Jewish, who assumed a non-Jewish last name. You know, we have, I think, or the guy out in California that killed six people.
Was
he
Asian,
was half white, half Asian. You know, so we're starting to see, I think, as we become more multiracial, more instances of people engaging in violence with animus against groups based on their understanding of who that other group is. And I think you're right. A lot of it does stem from ignorance, but it also stems from, I think, jockeying for position in society, right? And I think that there is a unfortunate myth in the African-American community that Latinos are coming in and they're taking our jobs. And I'm using quotes around our jobs for those who are not here in the studio. And I think that I wonder to what degree does that perception among adults filter down to the children? And that's what comes to my mind.
So let me tackle that for a moment. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. I know the last time we did this, it was a kind of a vociferous outcry on the show. I want to hear your thoughts. When I heard Anthony McCarthy's show last month on this and did another piece on it the other day, there were a lot of people called in really railing against Latino people in this community. We want to hear what you're thinking at 410-319-8888. Let me just say, Quinn, I think Zimmerman's dad was German, not Jewish, but Sterling is definitely Jewish.
Right.
And a lot of people progressed in the Jewish community when they heard Sterling was Jewish. Went, oh, no, why does he have to be? But
right. And there was the guy that shot the folks in the Jewish community center, I believe, in Kansas. So
right, exactly. All that
it's going all across.
So, but I told you about this photograph that was sent to my office today that we opened this morning here at WEA. And it was written by a man who runs a temp agency for laborers. And I don't have it in front of me. I'll give you his name. We'll get it in the office, and I'll tell you his name. But the picture showed a construction site with nothing but Latino workers, and he said, there are no black workers. So you go to things like the labor union, the laborers' labor union, and the vast majority of members of the laborers' labor union are black, with a minority being white and very few Latino members of that particular union. But it's a majority black union. And they're saying because there's no union jobs, men and some women, but mostly men in that union, are not getting work. And you hear people calling all the time talking about there are all these unemployed black men in this city with certain construction skills not getting work, but they're saying it's all Latino men who are getting the work in our community. I mean, let's just start there. I mean, because that perception, reality are two different things, but all of the mythology of some of this is based in some reality. So let's talk about that. I mean, that is part of the divide. It was a divide here in the 1840s in Baltimore when Frederick Douglass was working in the shipyards and the black and Irish workers were at each other's throats over who was going to get jobs in the shipyards. Mm-hmm. It's not a new scenario. Mm-hmm. But so what do we think about that? Let's talk about the reality of that because it means something to people. What does it mean? I mean, what do you do about it? How do you approach it? How much of it is reality? How much of it is myth?
Well, the way that capitalism works, it's a race to the bottom. You know, in education right now, there's a race to the top. Well, capitalism, there's always a race to the bottom. And so capitalists are always trying to import the lowest wage earners that they can find. So any group that's going to be marginalized or is vulnerable, and the Latino community is in terms of their immigration status, they're often, I think, looked at in terms of this low wage. And so they're abused, even as the folks that don't get jobs are abused. But I think a better historical comparison than 1840 is actually right after World War II in the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. And I think our education system and our, you know, cultural society, we do a poor job of understanding the African-American immigration story coming from the South to the North. And there was anxiety among white Northerners that these black folk were coming from the South to take their jobs. And so the very thing that the black community is mad about with the Latino community, we've experienced that before. And I think by not understanding what that history means for us, we're left to replicate the very same violence that has been produced against us.
Other thoughts? I mean, and I can talk also, wrestle with the reality of this. I mean, of people saying, and I really, there are a lot of people called in before on the show at 410-319-8888 saying that I see nothing but Latinos working. Where are the black faces?
Yeah, I think that when you have a visual symbol of your seeming inferiority in terms of seeing a person that you code as a different race working at a job that you code as yours, that's an emotional response that obscures some of the structural realities that produce that situation. You look at the situation of local hiring here, and it's pretty abysmal compared to a lot of other cities. You look at things like when you're having things like construction contracts, even some of our, I hate to say it, historically black universities aren't having the political pressure where they see when they have a construction project, actual community hiring being part of the thing they're pressured to have. And many of our black communities are so downtrodden. They say, what's the point? We could have this rally for local hiring and changing laws, but the politicians never listen to us. So you kind of have a vicious cycle where they don't see an economic alternative to their reality. So when economic development does happen, many of our communities are left out of that situation, which is why we at LBS have tried to push for local hiring and also really independent black institutions. Because I think what you're also seeing is the psychology of working in the black community, not wanting to necessarily feel like you're working for the man, but wanting to have something for your own, just sort of really wanting to feel independent. But when black independent economic growth has happened, we don't talk about it. We don't talk about Black Wall Street in Tulsa. We don't talk about slave communities, black communities. Had. So you have this narrative of work where you don't want to quote unquote work for the man, but that's not because you're lazy, it's because you have a collective memory of being exploited and having your economic input not valued. But you have a system where it's hard to have those folks in these black communities seen as assets to develop their own independent businesses for themselves. So it'd be great to see more investment there. And I think you see a lot of people who are seen as economically unviable would be jumping at the chance to have an independent economic venture, but they're not getting the opportunity because, again, we have a vicious cycle.
Luis?
Well, I would like to, you know, like tie a little bit into this capitalism, this system and how that works, you know, like, and think about where are the American jobs that have been exported to other countries for cheap labor? Like, why we don't talk about that? Mm-hmm. You know, like, why we ignore that a lot of, like, this is just a symptom of, and this is just how capitalism works in terms of, like, finding for the best way to exploit people, and how many times or how much can you divide, it will be equal at how much profit that you can make. Because by dividing those people, you create more cheap labor, you create more low wages, and of course your profit increase. And I do think I cannot not laugh of this person that sent you that picture that he runs a temp agency. I'm sorry, but we at United Workers we fight for the temp against the temp agencies that were hiring the workers at the stadium, African Americans and Latino workers that were making $4 per hour cleaning the stadium. So to me, it's laughable that he's like, oh, where is the old people? But it's like, to me, it sounds like, where is the people that I can exploit because I want to exploit more people, and it's ridiculous, you know, like to think about like. This is something deeper. Like when we think about like the society, but when we think about the political and the economy, the economic system that we are living on, like how that works, how that functions. The same companies that are exploiting people here in the U.S., African American, white, Latinos, are the same companies that are exploiting people in other countries. Mm-hmm. The same thing. We are talking about the same beast that is in Wall Street. We are not talking about nothing different. So it is really important for us to remember, like, our communities, like, most of the communities are living under stress because they are living under poverty. And poverty is caused by capitalism. It's not an accident. It's not natural. And we know that that those tensions, of course, occur, you know. And it's interesting that we as a society, we always also think about, like, I need to produce in order to be valuable. I need to, you know, we need to do that. We need to be exploited in order to be valuable. And because that's the mentality that the system has been putting on us. And so to me, it's really important to also think about like how we are getting exploited, not just in the U.S., but globally, because we are fighting with the same system.
So we have to take a quick break. We'll come right back. Let you come right back in, Lawrence. And we're also going to... go to the phones, Meredith and James and other callers calling in. We can write to your calls. So please don't hang up, Meredith and James. The first two callers up here, 410-319-8888. And I'll read Lewis Evans' letter, who sent the picture in, and we can respond to that letter as well, 410-319-8888. Please stay with us. We're going out with Guantanamera by Wyclef Jean. Wyclef Jean was arrested on this day in 2002 when he attempted to perform at a protest against education cuts in New York City. Wyclef Jean with the great Cuban song, Guantanamera. Overlooking Cuba, I asked her what's her name, she said Guantanamera. Remind me of an old Latin song my uncle used to play on his old 45 when he used to be alive. She went from a young girl to a grown woman like a virgin. Welcome back as we wrestle with what people are calling the Black-Latino divide in this community of ours, and much of it again brought to the fore by all of the tensions over the death of the young Latino man in Baltimore City last week. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We are here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health Policy. Here at Morgan State University, Luis Larin, who is leadership organizer for United Workers, Lawrence Grand Prix, assistant director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and an alumni of Baltimore City Public Schools, and Misael Garcia, who is a youth leader from Casa de Maryland and a member of their board, joins us by phone as well. And welcome to all of you. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
And we want to get back to the phones here. We said we would, but you had a thought, Lawrence, and then we'll introduce our other guests and get right to Meredith.
Yes. Briefly about the notion of sort of black-brown unity and its necessity, but the reality of quote-unquote black capitalism. I think it's important in the person who ran that temp agency who's black to sort of say that, look, we're dealing with a legacy of slavery that just ripped wealth out of black communities. So it looks like black capitalism and quote-unquote exploitation is, in many people's minds, just a pure survival strategy. So I think really taking that material reality seriously is important when you're dealing with the black community's sometimes fear of union organizing. It looks irrational to some people, but the history of labor unions hasn't necessarily been great to black people. We have the word scab in the 19th century was synonymous with the N-word in many places because blacks were used as strike breakers. And I saw a recent study that even when you had multiracial scabs, quote-unquote, people who crossed the picket line, they were seen and racialized as black by the union organizers picketing. So that fear of union organizing looks irrational, but there's something there, especially in terms of people uniting around jobs that exist. What about the people in the underground economy who have no connection to any sort of above-ground economy, and how do you get that money circulating in the black communities? Are unions really interested in that? So I think you have to have that conversation, too.
Ms. Ayel, welcome to the program. Did I say your name correctly, Ms. Ayel?
Yes.
Good. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me go right to the phone, as I promised, at 410-319-8888. And Meredith, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Meredith Moyes. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I'm calling as a person of Afro-Latino descent. My father was Panamanian, and this dialogue is a needed one. I see this through a lens of people not having dialogue around ethnicity and race, because there are many black Latinos, and black Latinos throughout the state of Maryland. In fact, one of Baltimore's own native sons, Carmelo Anthony, is African-American and Puerto Rican. So I'm wondering, are people reaching out to black Latino communities within the Latino community, within the black community? Are people consulting leadership who has done work around Afro-Latino issues? Have people consulted with the Afro-Latino Forum, a group of scholars that are based in New York, but I'm sure can engage in this dialogue? Because I feel like a lot of this violence is born from ignorance and it's born from poverty. People don't know. And so out of that, people are reacting to what they think is appropriate, and it's really not. So I'd be interested to see what type of efforts are being created to create dialogue, to disseminate knowledge and history so that we can better equip our children to understand one another and bridge these cultural divides. Because there are, like I said, black Latinos in the area who I'm sure would be willing to have this discussion. Carmelo Anthony has a center named after him. So has anybody reached out to him in regard to this, making appearances, so that we can start having this dialogue? Thank you.
Meredith, thanks so much. Michelle Garcia, let me ask you to kind of talk a bit about that, especially as a young person involved in CASA. Is any of that stuff going on?
Well, me as an organizer, and I'm a young adult also, we try to, educate, the Latino community on how, on about, black culture and, that way, so they can understand how, the black community works and we can work together as one community, also, with a lot of the kids that I work with, by sharing my story, I try to make them understand that, the violence just really doesn't help on a situation like this. So what we try to do is to try to motivate them and keep them in school. It is hard for some of the students, because a lot of them are newcomers to the country. So first of all, they have to learn the language, and they're new to the people around them. So we do as much to work together and make them understand that both communities need to stand together, if there is any differences. We can work it out by knowing each other, by knowing our culture, by knowing where we come from, by educating ourselves about both cultures. That way, just create a better community and live together in peace with each other. So,
let me reopen the phones here and also read this piece that just came in. 4103, would you want to say something?
Yeah, I want to respond. I thought the caller made a brilliant point about finding African Latino persons to help lead and guide this discussion, because there are people who are of African descent that are also Latino, and I think they can be a bridge over these troubled waters. So I think that's a brilliant point. And she also mentioned ignorance, And I think that goes to the fact that in our education system, a lot of our history books do not teach a sort of history, first of all, that lets people of African descent, people who are Latino, know who they are, where they come from. So if that's not in our textbooks, it's not in the Common Core, right? So if you don't learn who you are, and of course you would want to, you would hope that people learn this outside of school before they get to school. But if they don't, and this is where these fights are taking place, this violence is taking place, and if it's not in our education system, then it's opening the door to xenophobia and self-hatred, which is what internalized racism, a part of what that does. It produces a devaluation of who you are in your own eyes and who other people of color are in your eyes. And so I think we have to also look at not just like how we deal with this on the back end, but on the front end. We need liberatory educational curricula up front,
right,
that socializes and educates children so that they understand the common shared struggle that we share in a capitalist, racialized capitalist construct.
I mean, I'm going to go back to the phones here, but I just want to say that made me think of two things very quickly. When you talk about creating a curriculum, a liberatory kind of history that we could have, Luis Rodriguez was on the show last fall, and he's now the Green Party candidate for governor in California. But Luis is a Mexican-American, and he wrote this beautiful piece about that the person who led the struggle for Mexican independence was an Afro-Mexican leader. And then I just finished reading some books about the Latino struggles in slavery in Latin America, and that the struggles for freedom in Latin America were a lot of Afro-Latinos in the middle of those struggles, whether it was in the Andes or whether it was in Guatemala or in Honduras and Panama. And these are things that people don't know. We just see the divide. We don't understand the deep connections between those worlds. 410-319-8888. James, you're on the air. Hi, James, you're on the air. James, you there?
Hello?
James, you're on the air.
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can.
Yeah, I'm just commenting about the, you know, when people say they see a lot of Spanish people working for, you know, for contractors and stuff like that. You know, I'm a contractor myself. And I tried that earlier on, and then what I found out was that when they got jobs, they didn't call me. So what I do now is I don't hire them to work.
Hire who?
Hire Spanish Americans to work. Because when I reciprocate to them, they don't reciprocate back to me as far as being a brother that's, you know, that's struggling to get work, to do work. So I don't, so I'm stepping back from that particular type of hiring. You know, I'm mainly looking for just, you know, I'm sorry, but it's African American young men that want to do work. You know, I mean, I feel for their struggle coming over here to another country and trying to get work, but there's some of them that do get work. When they get work, they don't invite other people in to work. They keep it all to themselves, you know, and I don't think that's fair. So I don't know if there's some kind of, I'm missing an understanding or they're missing an understanding or what. You know, but I just don't do that.
But in some ways that their behavior makes sense. Ethnic solidarity is the only way that people survive in this country. When people, immigrants from other countries come, Vietnam, Korea, Chinese, they stick together. You know, and there's nothing wrong with ethnic solidarity. What we have to find, I think, is a space for inter-ethnic solidarity, interracial solidarity, especially among those people of color who are commonly and oppressed, you know, even though we have different histories and different origins. It's after we engage in sort of internal ethnic solidarity, how can we spread that out in terms of external inter-ethnic solidarity?
Well, I want to put this more deeply with the three of you. Let me just get two quick calls in here before we run out of time at 410-319-8888. A lot of people are calling in. Let's go to William. William, you're on the air.
I'm a person that's lived in many countries in the world, from Guyana to Aruba to England to Jamaica and also last
okay.
the United States. Anyhow, what I've noticed, my grandfather, his brother, youngest brother, was kidnapped off the coast of Guyana in 1927. Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, we glorified those kind of things, but we don't look at the backside of it. He didn't return until like 20-something years later. That's Barrington Bob. That's my youngest great uncle. Anyhow, I lived on Aruba for many years, from 59 to 64, and you would see the shows, the variety shows. They had a lot of Africans playing drums and congos. But as each year went on, they would get rid of the Congo drummers. And then, and by the time I left, it's like, wait a minute, where are all the African people? So you have to look on a global scale that that's what's happening. It's not just happening to Latinos. It's happening to black people, Chinese, Koreans. It's happening to everyone. So it's not a it's not really a racial thing. It's really trying to understand people as people and you know, let people live and enjoy their culture. You know, I've lived in England. I've experienced that racism too. So it's kind of, you know, even in the United States, when I first came here, the Africans would say, "Why don't you go back to where you come from?" And this is in East Orange, New Jersey. I mean, it's like, wait a minute, I'm living in a black community. They tell me to go back from where I'm coming from. You know, so. You have to look at it on a wider scale, not just what's right in front of you. You know?
William, that's really important. Let me get a quick call and get our guests kind of close out with their closing comments here. 410-319-8888. David, you're on the air.
Donna, how are you?
Very well.
All right, just real quick. This is another time where another incident of extreme situation should be a catalyst to have the African-American wake up and realize that until the African American identifies with their culture and not the pseudo, I was born in America, like the caller just said, I was born in Northwest Side or whatever. Every culture that comes in contact with the African American, while the African American is still cultureless, is going to have problems. This isn't a problem about humanity. It's the fact that the African American, while living in the colonies with the other nationalities, has no idea of who they are. When you look at the Latino Fest out at Patterson Park, it's phenomenal. When you have AFRAM, it's suspect, so to speak. And this is coming from people that I've spoken with directly and attending it. The African American needs to get rooted in their culture before the arrival in the, the colony. And that way, this might be able to foster some type of civility amongst all the other ethnicities.
David, thank you so much. So let me just get a closing thought here from our guests before we move on to the next subject, because I think what we've just heard here, and we only have 30 seconds left, we'll give them another minute because I want people to have a chance to close out their thoughts. The listeners have said to us just now that the divide is real. Mm-hmm. For all the theoretical reasons why we should unite, this divide is real.
Of course it's real, because capitalism is real, and divide and conquer is a tool, a primary tool and weapon of capitalism. And it's not just, it's a struggle for resources. It's also a struggle for land. When you look at gentrification, immigration, there's a struggle for space and identity and culture as well.
Yeah, of course, racism is real. Of course, divisions are real. Of course, we have been trained to hate each other. We have been trained to survive each other. The U.S. mentality mainly is, you are in your own, and there's no sense of community. There's no sense of integration. There is no sense of accepting other people as different than you. And of course, those things are real. And I think Lawrence just hit on something really critical, which is the fight for resources. You know, like housing, healthcare, jobs, everything. And like it is real. Everyone is trying to survive. And capitalism is it's generating profit, exploiting other people, and putting other people in poverty. So those things are real, and divisions are real.
Lawrence?
Yeah. This is a tough conversation, and it requires tough truths. The reality is we have to have the conversation around capitalism, but also racism and specifically anti-blackness. Unfortunately, even in the Latino world, there's rampant anti-blackness. Look at Argentina moving out all the black people in their country. And I agree with Lawrence completely. We have to have a curriculum that talks about it, but there are many examples of cooperation between communities that just don't get talked about. We had a caravan for peace and justice that brought together blacks and Latinos. Sun didn't cover it. We have a curriculum about Afro-Latino relations. Nobody's covering it. We at LBS are trying to do that. We'll continue that. But we have to realize there's lots of cooperation that's less spectacular than the violence. But we got to talk about the cooperation.
And we'll be happy to cover it. Ms. Royal Garcia, a very quick closing thought.
Yes. Yes, sir. Well, thank you, everyone, and for your comments. And what I want to say basically is that we as leaders, we must learn to lead by example, first of all, and also teach our youth, right, to from elementary to high school, that, you know, and educate them about both cultures, and learn how to work together, and also, you know, just like I mentioned earlier, just work as one community, learn our differences, and but also learn our similarities as well. And that way we can become, you know, one community and stand together and
all right.
And fight for our rights.
Misrael Garcia, part of ACASA de Maryland. Good to have you with us. Luis Lorin, United Workers. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, professor at Morgan State University. Lawrence Grand Prix from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I'll leave you this closing thought from one of my producers, Stephanie Mavronis, who wrote in as a way to think about this one for our next conversation. She writes in, when I was a part of the Unite Here boycott committee, there was so much tension between the largely African-American service employees and the Latino day laborers that the hotel would bring in when the employees were boycotting. They laid them off to replace them with day laborers. These employees and capitalism pits people who should be allies against each other. So we close with that thought and thank our guests for being here and all of you for calling in and writing in. We now go to our conversation about the curfew in Baltimore City. Stay with us. Good night.